and welcome to the Trust Your Body Project. Trust Your Body Project is a podcast and social media movement designed to help you heal, eat, and create space for the things that truly matter. I'm your host, Whitney Catalano. I'm an anti-diet, health at every size registered dietitian, helping you stop dieting, make peace with your body, and take the power back from your inner bully. Welcome to episode number 26. On today's episode, you are in for a treat. I'm smiling ear to ear. Also, that saying is so cute, but I'm smiling ear to ear because I did this interview a while ago. It's with Ailey Jolie, who is a therapist up in Canada, and she wrote a book, My Body, My Story, and she has gone through just unbelievable trauma in her life. Sexual trauma, sexual exploitation, and we don't get into any specifics. So for those of you who are triggered by talk of sexual trauma, I'm telling you right now, we don't really get into the specifics of what happened or her story. We're more so talking about the themes of healing. So I actually think that this interview is going to be really powerful for everyone. If you've never experienced trauma like that, I still highly, highly, highly recommend that you listen to this interview. We talk about everything. We talk about, you know, perfectionism and how her eating disorder served as an escape from her trauma and how she had to go through this whole rebellion phase after, you know, breaking free from the perfectionism and just finding herself and what she refers to as embodiment. And she gives some practical advice and tips around becoming embodied and experiencing embodiment. She talks about, you know, dating in the context of our trauma and how, you know, symptoms tend to be projected into other areas of our lives. It's just the best interview. Not only that, but her just mere presence is so healing and so powerful. She's probably one of the most powerful people I've ever even come into contact with just because of how she's just special. She's really amazing. So I'm very excited for you to listen to this interview. And I thought it would be perfect for you to hear it, you know, right after last week's episode about emotional burnout. So before we get into the interview, I wanted to give a little update on me because, first of all, thank you so much to everyone who reached out, who shared your kind words, but also to everyone who was touched by last week's interview. I mean, last week's interview, what am I saying? Last week's podcast episode, I really felt that I needed to share it with the world, and I had no idea what I was going to really talk about when I went into recording that episode, and it sounded like it came at a perfect time for those of you who heard it and it resonated with you. So I'm beyond grateful that I have this platform to be able to share and connect because, you know, like I said last week, too many of us are burnt out and too many of us expect burnout and have normalized burnout, and the world has normalized burnout. So the more we know and the more self-awareness we embody, the better off we're going to be in this journey. So sometimes it just takes someone saying exactly what you're going through for you to be like, oh, wow, it's time to make a change. And I've had so many DMs from people on Instagram saying that you've, you know, taken steps to slow down and make changes in your life. And that is everything. I'm so happy. In terms of an update on me, I'm actually doing pretty well right now. I am still slowing down. I'm seeking the perfect therapist, and not every therapist can be perfect, but someone who I think is going to be suitable for where I'm at right now. But honestly, there was this power that came from just allowing myself, like radically allowing myself to be in that place. And this is why I was inspired to share this interview with you all today, because truly this is what we talk about in the interview. Is just like allowing yourself to be in that space and slowing down. And it's so funny because I did this interview however many months ago, and it just now became appropriate to share for me in terms of the timing of it all. So like the divine intervention that I use to plan my content, because I like to post things when I feel inspired to post them. This I think is coming at the exact time that it needs to. And I'm so excited. So yeah, I'm doing well. I am working. I'm going to a doctor and I did blood tests today, and I'm going to continue to learn about hormones and support them and, you know, all that jazz. So very excited about that. And I feel my creativity is back. I have you know, completely changed my group coaching program, which I'm going to be launching pretty soon, which is wild, honestly, because I've been kind of stressing about my group coaching program for the past year and testing it with different groups. I've done it a few different times now, and the way that I'm going about it in this new round is entirely different, way more efficient, way more healing. Like, it's just so, when I got that burst inspiration and that creativity again, I was like, I'm back. Like, I'm so happy. So yeah, I still have my sad days. I still have my days of like, what is going on? But you know what? It's all a journey, and I'm slowing down, which is cool. Feels good. So that's what's going on with me. I would encourage that if you are going through anything right now, to talk about it, own it, so that you can start to let it go. But we can't let it go until we own it. And actually, Ailey talks about that. So like I said, this is the perfect egg. Today's coaching pitch, if you will, is a little bit different because I feel inspired to talk to those of you who feel as though you go through things in your life, challenges in your life, because you are being called, or your purpose is to teach others and to help others. So what you learn about yourself, you are able to then help others. If that is you, I cannot recommend getting help with mindset work, getting help with healing more. And if you're here because of food, I'm sure it's showing up in other areas of your life. And what's interesting is that when I have those clients, it only takes one session for us to figure out, you know, in our 6-month program, but it only takes one session for us to figure out like, okay, that is your why. So let's combine this. Let's combine the food healing with the mindset work around feeling worthy enough to teach, feeling worthy enough to pursue your dreams of helping others and not be tied down to the 9-to-5 or whatever it is, you know, really feeling empowered in yourself and preparing yourself mentally and emotionally for the journey that is helping others, because it is a journey. It will force you to learn so much about yourself. And I would not be where I am today if I hadn't been doing the mindset work all year with coaches. So I would highly encourage you to invest in a coach to help you, someone who feels aligned, intuitively aligned with you. And if that's me, you can apply for a free discovery call at Whitney, or clarity call at whitneycatalano.com/book. If it's not me, I would encourage you to find someone, because if you're not currently helping others in the way that you've envisioned for yourself, or you're not currently, you know, doing the things because there are blocks getting in the way, working with someone will be instrumental to you helping others, because you will learn tools and skills, and you will just learn to get out of your own way. And then you will get back in your own way, and then you're going to have to get out of your own way again, and then back in it, and then out, and then in, and it's, you get it. So I would highly, highly, highly encourage you to seek support around that. And if you are inspired by me and you feel as though, even if you don't want to do food stuff, you don't want to help people with food stuff, but you know that your food and your body image stuff is getting in the way of you doing the things you do want to do, I would love to be on that journey with you. It is my absolute all-time favorite work. So that's what it is. WhitneyCatalano.com/book. And to, of course, thank the people who left reviews on Apple Podcasts. Elise Geithner, Shayna Felena, I think, and P.T. Smitler. So thank you all for leaving reviews. Please, please, please go leave reviews on Apple Podcasts, please. So, and share my podcast with everyone. The last thing I want to say is a quick disclaimer that towards the end of the episode, we talk about dating people or surrounding yourself with people who struggle with addiction. And I use the word addict as opposed to person who struggles with addiction. And I, at that time, I didn't know. I just didn't know. I didn't know that you're supposed to, I didn't know how to talk about it, because I grew up, as you all know from my first episode, if you listen to it, my dad struggled with addiction. And so I just repeated, in regards to talking about addiction, I just repeated what I had heard from others, which is like addict, you know, but it is someone who's struggling with an addiction. It does not define you. It's not your identity. It's just you're struggling with addiction, or they are struggling with addiction. So if that is aggravating or triggering to you that I use that word, I'm sorry in advance. I know now not to. I did this interview a long time ago. I didn't know. So all I can do is keep growing, keep changing. So I hope it doesn't distract from the interview. That's kind of it. Because, I mean, what am I saying? What else am I supposed to say about it other than I'm learning and thank you for your patience and thank you for your love and your compassion with me. And like I always say, if there's anything that I say wrong or anything that you're like, that's not how you're supposed to talk about it or whatever, let me know. I'm open to feedback. I adjust very quickly because I'm here to learn and that's the whole thing. So yes, with that being said, oh my gosh, I'm so excited for you to listen to this interview. She is just the best. So let's get into it, shall we? So for today's main dish, we are talking to Ailey Jolie, who is passionate about embodiment, about supporting others living fully and wholly in their body. So she is a trauma therapist, yoga teacher, meditation guide, and an internationally published author. So I know that you literally just told me you are working on a second master's degree in depth psychology with an emphasis on somatic studies. You also work full-time as a therapist. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you.
I know. I'm so excited too. This really worked out. I remember I emailed you because I like saw your page and saw your website and was instantly a fan. And then when I emailed you, you were like, oh my gosh, I'm a fan of you. And I was like, what? What do you mean? No.
Mutual fangirling.
Yeah, it's necessary. So we're just going to dive in because... Okay, so I read your book. It took a while for it to get here. Once it got here, I'm glad we pushed back the interview. So worth it. I'm so glad I read your book. Like, I don't even have words for how beautiful it is and how much I sobbed on an airplane when I first started reading it and was like, oh, I shouldn't read this in public. Okay, that's good to know.
You need the disclosure. Like, please read alone on a Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, I think people will find that out pretty quickly. But tell me a little bit about just your, I guess, everything's so loaded. But tell me a little bit about the book just on like a high level.
High level. Yeah. So the book chronicles my experiences of moving from sexual exploitation into embodiment and what that looked like and how I moved through the process of like really owning my experiences of trauma and like honoring like how the eating disorder had been in my life in a way to cope with just tremendous and turbulent pain. And what that whole experience of like really shifting from like deeply being not in my body to deeply having to listen to the wisdom of my body to be able to be free looks like. So it kind of chronicles through, and it was written over a decade. And they were just like bits and pieces that I ended up taking and brought to women that I love and adore and were on my journey and was like, what feels most pertinent and resonant? And got them to give me that feedback to then make a collection of what this looked like.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. It's unbelievable. Anyone who's a fan of like Rupi Kaur, I never know how to say her last name correctly, will resonate with your work because I find that it's the similar type of digestible, like small thoughts organized in a greater motif, if you will.
Yeah, it's got that, digestible is a really good word of like, how do we actually, when we've gone through our healing experience, I find in other authors like Rupi or Eve Ensler, there's a different quality where you can synthesize maybe what took 10 years with a therapist into just 10 lines of writing because it is so deeply held in the body. It's so clear. It has so much transparency that then language is easy with it because it's so known.
Yeah. Yeah. You get that sense of, you say these few lines that are so powerful throughout that are like resonate like universal truths in the context of something that is so unique and so just horrible, really.
Yeah.
Messy. Yeah.
Messy is the word that I like to use with trauma because I view trauma as anything that overwhelms our physiology to stay connected. And so connected to self or connected to other. And when we're not connected and our body is overwhelmed, life is like chaos. Like it's just, we are then uprooted from anything earthly to actually put our flag into. We are in the ether, essentially floating.
Yeah. And I really resonate with that because, I mean, no matter how like disordered eating shows up in your life, I think that's something that is relatable to anyone who's experienced it because you do feel like this disconnection from your body.
Yeah. And disconnection from self, disconnection from others. You're just like this thing kind of being bumped around in the current and
totally.
Yeah. Grasping for any sense of control or any perceived paddle that's going to help you get out. And yeah.
Yeah. It's powerful. I think, you know, the thing that was really fascinating to me is that, you know, I could see how someone who might be sensitive depending on their own history to your writing, because it is so, so deeply understood. Like you really are laying it all out there. Like you said, decades of learning and going to therapy in just a few lines. Like it really took me on a journey. But I think, you know, one of the interesting things is that you don't have to have experienced what you in particular experienced to like resonate with so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that it might be really healing for people to read.
Yeah, that was a lot of my intention in being so disclosing. And one of the things that I often share when I'm asked to do advocacy work, which I don't do as much of anymore, is because I deeply believe that trauma cannot be compared.
Mm-hmm.
Because of my story, sometimes I have more ability to say this, which is a whole other thing to be unpacked. But what happens to you is irregardless of the feelings that it leaves you with. The story is what it is and it will be what it will be. But what did it leave you with? What mark does it have on your soma and your soul and your spirit? That is what matters.
Mm-hmm.
That is where real healing comes. And if we're doing any of those other things relationally, we're in a relational place of like, because you hurt me or because I went through all of these things, there it's an out of self and real kind of like healing and embodiment is coming back to self. And like, okay, what emotions in this moment do those things that happened, how are they still here? What can I do to soothe them or offer them compassion? Or maybe they need to be expressed and it's anger, like whatever, you know? And sometimes that gets missed or we start comparing trauma and it's like, that isn't my experience of healing and that isn't my experience of peace. Comparison hasn't ever led me there. That's all I can speak to is my personal journey of that. That's why I'm so tentative sometimes around you never want to apply an absolute truth to a relative human experience. Not helpful. What's helpful is to be in the moment with that person. It's like, your pain, I hear you. How can I be with you? You know, getting into that back and forth, it's not helpful. And I remember people who used to say that to me when I was in therapy and I was like really like clinging to my story. It was who I was and it justified me. And that was also important in owning it. So then at some point I could go, I'm going to put you down maybe for today. And I was like, maybe for today and tomorrow. And it became this process. But it is also so important to know that you can hold it and own your story and say that was wrong and this happened to me and that was not okay. As with everything, it's messy and it's gray and there's...
no kidding. Yeah. So before we dive into some of the themes, I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more because in the interview questions, you were like, I was like, what do you want me to talk about? And you're like, embodiment. And I was like, okay, well, you got to just tell me. I know what you mean, but why don't you explain a little bit more about embodiment, what that means for you?
Totally. I'm going to like filter myself a little bit because I could just rant about embodiment forever. The starting point for me is always just like, we don't live in a world where we're taught to feel our bodies, to know our bodies, to understand them, to be present for them. If anything, we're taught the opposite through social media, through patriarchy, through feminism. Like, we don't have a lot of gauge of what's going on in our body. And so a lot of the work that I do around embodiment is just like the general awareness of like, hey, you have like a body, and like, how does it feel? Like, do you know what your clothes feel like on your skin? And just starting to gauge some of that interoception and actually grow this part of the brain called the insula. So it's a lot of what I do in embodiment work. And a lot of it kind of stays at that level. And then the next piece kind of is around like the relationalness of that. Like when I'm in the presence of someone, what do I notice in my body? How can my body offer me wisdom? And beautiful neuroscience has shown us that like anything that feels off or overwhelming or traumatic, whatever that looks like, breakup without support, you know, a pet dies, they don't have to be these horrific things. Trauma can just be, you know, you went to school and someone was teasing you and mom didn't offer you comfort. Like that's traumatic for a little child. All of those emotions and sensations get stored in the body. And so embodiment, although presently is like this really sexy term, especially disordered eating, everyone's like, embodiment, be in your body. And I have this caution of like coming into your body and feeling things is also going to be turbulent and messy because the body holds and stores negative emotions. And as you come into the body, don't be surprised if your symptoms go up because it's something new. Mm-hmm. And you've used a lot of tools to stay out of your body. So you're going to probably want to jump back out as we're working to get in. So it's a modulation.
Yeah. And I think that's truly where the skill of the practitioner needs to come in to one, not take that personally. Feel like, oh my gosh, they're experiencing symptoms. I want to stop their symptoms or whatever.
Yes.
And two, to like know how to navigate through that and explain that that's normal and that's to be expected.
Totally.
And scary.
Yes.
And messy.
Super messy. And
yeah.
That piece about the practitioner is so important. You know, having embodiment isn't just practicing mindfulness. Like there are specific tools and practices that are somatic meditation, somatic practices to feel your body. And our own capability to know our central nervous system comes from really the amount of time we've actually spent healing and releasing our own trauma and what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And that is a whole process because you can really only attune to someone else if you can fully attune to yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's why embodiment is a really murky term to just being tossed around everywhere. It's like, ooh, this is actually a much deeper concept that we're missing some pieces of.
Yeah, absolutely. To kind of dive in to the book a little bit. So your book is called My Body, My Story. It's very suited. I want to start with the disclosure at the beginning. And I thought it was really interesting and really set the tone for the book because you say outright, like, my story is not special. The thing that's special is that I'm no longer living in it. And I thought that was like so cool. So tell me about why you put that piece in it.
Yeah. That piece is just like in my fullest heart. Because it's so unbelievably genuine. What I lived is, yes, atrocious and terrible, but is not unique. Every day, people are going through various systems of violence and sexual violence or sex trafficking or sexual assault or living in an eating disorder, or disordered eating, or those are not unique experiences. Mm-hmm. What is unique is that I had enough of those in my early life to go, oh my God, this is not okay. I am broken and I am not even, you know, a full adult yet. And I actually don't know what it's like to see in color because I've been so sick for so long and people touch me and I don't know what that feels like. I had all of those in this very condensed short amount of time in my early life. And that was the special piece, is that it was so intense, so early, that there was this part that went, I think there's something different to human life. Mm. And I genuinely do believe that over the course of someone's life, the severity and the complexity of what I experienced with different storylines is a part of the life. Mm-hmm. In different ways. Mine was just right at the beginning, and so it was so obvious that there was something there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a therapist, I witnessed these stories. I looked to the women that were in my life at this time. Their stories were similar. My mother's story, my grandmother's story. And so for me, it was like, this isn't unique. And yet no one is talking about that, talking about the lack of uniqueness. Mm-hmm. And being a part of the advocacy realm prior to writing the book, I really saw women who did disclose their story kind of get celebrated for that. Hmm. And there's a piece of like, that's amazing they can stand in their story. And also, what about all of the other invisible women standing beside them that don't have a voice yet? Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to make that clear that I wasn't like stepping forward. I was standing beside.
Right. Yeah. And hoping that it would encourage other people to just stand in their story.
Yeah.
Whatever that looks like. Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah. Because for most people, that's not going to be publishing a book. But
no.
For some, and that we need, you know, we need the range. Like we need the spectrum mm-hmm. of people to do what feels right. Because that's just how humans are. We kind exactly. of occupy an entire spectrum at all times.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, for some people, that's not going to be publishing. For some people, that's going to be like journaling or just internal reflection. And those are all so important. All that matters in my perspective is that we honor and own our story. Mm-hmm. How, what we do with it, that doesn't matter. Just that we know it and learn. Yeah.
I love that. One of the biggest themes, obviously, throughout this whole thing is like safety means playing it small and staying small. Mm-hmm. And this is a theme that will continue to, you know, when you know something and you work with clients over and over again on that thing, and then you still are continued to be like in awe of how resonant it is. Mm-hmm. So playing small, tell me a little bit about your, like how that shows up.
Yeah, it shows up in my personal life or in my work with clients.
Ooh, what would you like to share?
Yeah, I can speak to both.
Okay.
So playing it small is such a huge theme. It's like this strange, as you said, like it's kind of like this universal thing. And we can look to patriarchy and a lot of that, those other systems to find that place. But when I'm working with it with a client, I often do the brave thing of allowing them to play it small, to actually like, okay, together, you're going to sit there and I'm going to sit there and we're going to be as small as we can and just like try that on. And it's challenging for me as a therapist to witness someone like go into this small state and be in those emotions. But I just actually today had a client who stayed there for about 52 minutes. We stayed in the small state and I was just inside. I was like, oh my goodness. Like, I don't think I can stay in this pain any longer. Like, this is taking a lot out of me. Like, I have other clients today. Like, maybe I should invite her out. And then she was just like, I don't feel alone anymore. I think I can do something different. And my heart just melted in that moment. And the smallness for me and how I work as a therapist is like, okay, what is it just like to have someone else meet you there, meet you in your desire to be small without any like changing, fixing. I'm just here with you. I'm in it. I witness you. I'm here when you're out of it too. And that's what I had modeled. It's hard when you are to be that attuned to someone in their experience. And it isn't something that I notice happening very often, my desire to be small, but it still comes up at times when, especially in some of the work that I do around consulting, white men, a lot of power, a lot of privilege. I'm coming in here and I'll feel it. And I'm like, oh, okay. And now I can somatically sense when it's coming on before the thoughts start. Mm. And then it's like, okay, can I take up my space? Okay, full belly breathing, like as much space as I possibly can take. I'm going to take and stand in that. So now I see it show up more in a somatic structural way than a thought process of playing it small. Mm. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, a very interesting distinction there. Mm-hmm. I think part of that sort of emotional mastery, if you will, is understanding when it shows up in the body first, mm-hmm. before the thoughts get on their runaway train to nowhere. And it's hard to catch them when they're already on board.
Yeah,
they're gone.
You've already got on the train and you're going for the ride and you,
Yeah. So if you can start to notice when it shows up in the body, you get a little bit of a leverage on it. And then you're like, okay, either acknowledge it now, deal with it now, or adjust now, acknowledge it later.
Yeah.
That's funny. I always give my clients that sort of permission of like, if you're at work and something comes up, you can shelf it. Like you can put it on the shelf for later.
Totally.
Cause that's, you know, you gotta also be at work, you know?
Definitely. Yeah. You are allowed to do that.
Yeah. And I think that's what's interesting too, right? Because disordered eating, eating disorders, any sort of kind of control numbing relationship with food or with anything really, there's this sort of fine line in recovering of like, reconnecting with the body, reconnecting with our emotions, processing the things that we've been trying to numb, mm-hmm. while also giving ourselves permission to numb occasionally, like in a way that's supportive and helpful for you.
Totally. And I am sometimes transparent with my clients, more often than not, that a huge piece of my eating disorder recovery was a conscious kind of numbing with relationships with men that didn't serve me. And I had a therapist who was like very clear. She was like, okay, let's get the food stuff online. Let's get you back to a healthy weight. This relationship, we both know it's not good for you. And I'd be like, yeah, I know. She'd be like, this is where the stuff is right now. I'd be like, yep, I know. And she's like, we're going to work on that in 8 months when you're physically well. I'd be like, yep, I know. Like,
it oh my God.
Like conscious process of she was like, we're going to let the symptoms be here, mm-hmm. and get you and your body physically stable, well, in touch, in tune. And her intuition was right. The relationship faded away. When I was well and doing my thing and had, you know, relatively enough time in my vessel feeling good, I was like, oh, like, I just actually really don't like being around him. That just doesn't feel good anymore.
Yeah.
She had that awareness to stay centered on my body and my recovery and creating that embodiment there and not getting lost in my beautiful stories about this relationship that wasn't serving me, but that I wasn't willing to leave either.
Right. Yeah. I've been there. I acknowledge that. Yeah. I get, And it is interesting too. There's something really powerful about being able to recognize, I know that this part of my life is where my symptoms or whatever are showing up, and I'm not in a place to do anything about it.
Yes.
So I will, but I'm going to also give myself space to not right now.
Yes.
And that's cool.
Exactly. And cool needs to be celebrated, have self-compassion around, like, recovery is a process. And more than that, like, life is messy. And like, there isn't going to be a destination of like self-acceptance or self-love or like self-forgiveness. Like, those are working principles. Mm-hmm. Always. You're always working them. You're never, you know, it's a destination, not an arrival point. So
yeah. Ooh, I loved this line. So real beauty is not defined by external validation or ever even seen. Real beauty is felt.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, just to give you some personal context, that is something that I'm experiencing for the first time in the past few months of like really like going somewhere. I went to this, you know, late night warehouse thing in LA, classic. And I hate those things. And I felt so awesome one night and was just showed up and was like in my full power and was just like radiating. Like I could feel myself just exploding in energy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. Like nothing about my body has really changed, mm-hmm. but this is like palpable. You can feel it. So tell me about that and how maybe you help clients sort of come into that.
Yeah, that is another thing I'm so passionate about. Along my journey, I have had, so I there's this thing that I know that I'm very different when it comes to women. Most women, when they see someone, they're like, oh, she's really beautiful, or she's really radiant. They're like, oh, like maybe I'll go talk about her. Like, I don't want to be around her. And I'm like, you come here. Let's be best friends. Mm-hmm. My whole life, I've been like that. And so when I was in my recovery process, I started reflecting on, okay, like, I'm not this anymore. I'm well, but like, what does beauty mean for me? And what does that look like? And who are the people that I find most beautiful? And I actually started journaling, about like, what were their qualities? And more than that, like, how did I feel in their presence? What was it? And the interesting thing about this list is that all of these women were like 40, 50, 60, like conventionally were not, you know, young, beautiful, thin, whatever anymore. There was a different, like, je ne sais quoi, a different quality about them. And that really led me to be like, okay, like when I'm around them, like I feel different inside. Like I feel more beautiful and more shiny and more of these things. And from that place, then I was able to gauge, okay, like, what are these women doing that are different? And for me, those women were showing up in their full honesty. They were showing up messy, you know, with unbrushed teeth sometime. I did a training with Sean Korn, and like, you could tell she was just like disgruntled, but I loved it because she's so fiery and fierce. And that felt sense. It is different when you meet someone who has that something that it's, for me, it's, there are no words to it. It's like this effervescent essence that you can witness, and it precedes the physical form. Mm-hmm. And I think that's different for everyone, depending on what they're attracted to or what they're most needing in that moment. And so I do a lot of work with clients around asking, like, who are the women you look up to the most? Exterior aside, who are the people that you're most drawn to? And if they were in the room right now, what would being in their presence feel like? Or when you witness something by them, one of the women that for me that really held that space was Brooke Axtell. She's also another survivor of child sex trafficking. And I remember just watching her speak and just being like, wow, she's so beautiful because she is so unbelievably honest in her pain. And what she's offering the world is wow. And it just, there's a different quality, and we're all going to have those different people that radiate that for us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. This interview is coming at such an interesting time for me. I'm working with some, like, a business coach who does this kind of stuff. Like, she was an MFT, and then she went to the University of Santa Monica, their spiritual whatever program. Have you heard of it?
I have heard of it. Yeah.
Everyone comes out of there just like walking on air, and you're like, what did you do? They released all their stuff. They dealt with it, you know? But she, so one of the exercises that she had us do a couple months ago was, who do you admire? What do you admire about them? And like, how do you have that in yourself? And that blew my mind, because I was like, oh my gosh, I don't have to be threatened by the people who I admire. Because I admire them because I see something that resonates with me.
Yeah, I love, I can't remember what woman said it to me, but I do, it's not coming, but she said, like, what you see in me, Ailey, is just a reflection of what's in you. That's mm-hmm. the only reason you can see it, is because it's in you. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being like, well, okay.
Like, are you sure?
Yeah. That was like 15 years ago. It was quite some time, but I remember that moment and being like, okay, cool. And the other piece that I found really healing, especially with the competitive narrative women have and kind of seeing this beauty in other women, was being unapologetic and naming it to them. So when my book got published, I sent a copy to Eve Ensler, who is like, you know, Eve.
Yeah.
You don't need to say any more about that. And having her write back to me and say, like, wow, I could feel this in my body. And being able to have just even some small dialogue about what it gave her was just like, oh, it's in me too. What I see in Eve is here also. And having those experiences, even though they're they're a little big and they're a little bold, those women are accessible and they will receive you. Mm-hmm. And having that trust too.
Yeah, I have goosebumps. I love that. That's amazing. Ooh, okay. So I loved these themes of perfection and seeking perfection from in the context of the external world, right? And realizing that the closer you got to perfection or whatever, the further you got from yourself. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that and a little bit too about what comes after that, which is like the full rebellion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the best thing in my life. Yeah. So perfection was like, I would say groomed into me from like a very young age, but it really took its talents when I got introduced to modeling and pageants. And so I had won some pageants and I was supposed to go represent Canada over abroad. And now there was this very intense exterior voice correcting everything that I was doing. Every mannerism, every way I sat, every way I walked, every piece of me was now up to scrutiny. And on top of that, there was this very intense perception that my life was happy and perfect, because who wouldn't be? And that, like, that was the, like, you've exteriorly made it at a very young age. And I had so many people filtering my life to make it look like that too. Mm-hmm. And that is the other piece that I feel like is really important to name in the social media era. It is like there's a collaborative effort to make these people's lives look perfect. Mm-hmm. It's not just one person, because I actually don't think one person could make the ruse look that good. If anyone had like an unfiltered conversation with me at that point in my life, they would have been like, something isn't all there. She's a little off. I wasn't seeing color. I didn't taste anything.
You literally weren't seeing color.
Literally wasn't seeing color.
Oh.
The eating disorder had taken that much from me. So like literally there were some very real things that were very off with me. Whoa. That you would have known if like we were having an interaction, but because my life was so filtered and tailored and had to look this certain way to be in this pageant and such, those things weren't disclosed. Hmm. The more perfect my life became in the exterior way, the more sick I became, the further away I moved away from myself. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that conversation in the realm of social media and what we're posting is oftentimes missed and not disclosed or talked about. Like there's a very conscious collaborative effort, and the people that are in it are oftentimes they've lost their voice. They're swept up in the current of it.
Yeah.
So there's that piece. And when I had my moment where I was like, okay, like there's some really messed up stuff going on here. I need to leave. Like da 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 da. I moved to like a city that I had never been to. I signed up at a university that isn't actually English first. Didn't have the cerebral cognitive processing to check if my university was English first.
Okay.
It was French first.
Got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I found that out my first day of university classes when my professors kept switching between French and English. And I was like, oh shit, mm-hmm. Where am I? And really did everything that I could to extract myself from that image, deleting all my social media accounts, no longer having Facebook, no longer having Instagram for years, just retracting and pulling as much as I could. And then on top of that, after going through eating disorder recovery, adapting some like very feminist beliefs. So like I went away to India, I cut off all my hair, I got all the tattoos, I did all the piercings, like I dated all the bad boys, I got messy and I got dirty and I, grew out my fingernails and all those stereotypes of like a dirty hippie.
Yeah.
I was like, yes, this one right here.
Yeah.
And I think that period was so important to get dirty, to not be afraid of that, to let my body do whatever it needed to do. And for me, that period actually still felt so natural. And there wasn't a lot of guilt and shame. And there wasn't a lot of judgment on my body. Because I was like, I am tired of being perfect. I am tired. And you know what? I've done my hair for most days for the past like 2 decades. I'm not going to wash my hair for a few months. And I know that that was very extreme. And a lot of people would be like, oh, I don't know. I don't want to go that far. I don't want to run away to India. I hear you. There's little ways that you can bring that into your recovery where it doesn't have to be that big. Mm-hmm. For me, it felt important to be that big.
Yeah. I also get the, I like could not get more the concept of running away to another country. That is like something powerful about it.
Totally. And I honestly feel like that's where a lot of my recovery was strengthened the most, was in travel.
Yeah.
Because I was confronted with myself and confronted with aspects that, you know, were being pointed out to me in therapy that I didn't want to look at. And I was like, oh shit, like that's a real thing. Mm-hmm. And, or when relational dynamics would repattern, it was like, oh, I just ran away from that. And now I'm in another country and it's happening again. I think this is about me. Like,
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I try to explain to my clients all the time, this sort of this, so the pendulum, like the binge restrict pendulum, we all know it. We've all been there, but I'm like, look, the binge restrict pendulum applies to everything.
Yes.
Everything is a pendulum or a spectrum, and a spectrum is a pendulum. If you think about it hard enough, like it's all the same. There's nothing is stable. And we do have to swing the other way, yes, with food, but also with like these actions in our life that are big.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And even for myself, I spent some time in medical school and like, I know that that was deeply rooted in like being a model and being a dancer and just like being exteriorly beautiful and no one ever listening to anything I said in my mouth. So I was like, I will do 2 undergrads and I will get into medical school and people will listen to me. I got into medical school. I did some time there and I was like, oh my God, they actually don't care. And I don't need to prove myself. And okay, I do feel intelligent now and I can let this identity go. Mm-hmm. But that pendulum had to swing to make up for all those times I felt inferior or like I wasn't being heard. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think it's just having that awareness of like, there is a balance and a homeostasis in life overall. But at periods and times in our life, we may be on extremes. And that's
okay. Yeah, it is okay. And we can't look at that with shame or guilt. Well, and if we do, that's a sign in itself that we got to look at that, you know? But it's like looking at it with shame and guilt is not helping it or doing yourself any service. It's just, you know, kind of distracting from the acceptance piece.
Yeah. And I get it. Like acceptance sucks. It doesn't feel good. It's not the most comfortable place to be, but it is the only place that's like in the present moment. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's powerful. And, you know, I think it is definitely a theme of privilege, this whole running away to a different country. Like that is, could not be a more privileged way to run from your problems. Totally. But I think that it's relatable on so many different levels, because if another country is not your manifestation of that, I'm sure you've got one, whoever's listening, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Running away into a new career, a new apartment. Like I hear clients talk about that. Like, oh, I'm going to move. Or I'm going to get a new job. Mm. Or I'm going to change my friend group. Or I'm going to cut off my hair. Or like there's lots of ways that that energy or archetype shows up in different ways. And yes. I've noticed in my life, like now I'm pretty rooted in Vancouver. I don't have the opportunity to run away from things, but I'll notice that I'm like, oh, I want to make that shift or like that thing. And I'm like, okay, what's that energy about? What are you doing right now?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes. So speaking to me. So I think that probably the last place I want to dive into that was what you said about going to a different country, being in relationships that repeated patterns of old things that, you know, are written into your genes, like you said. And specifically, what I find really fascinating is what you talked about, where dating an addict and mm-hmm. feeling like you, part of that was wanting to rewrite their story and be like, I'm the reason that they got sober. I'm the reason that the story ending changed. Mm-hmm. And oh my gosh, you know, children of addicts, codependents around, they always find me because, hello, I attract, you know, the things that I'm working on healing. And I read that part and was just like, okay, we need to talk about this.
A huge piece of my dating experience from like a very young age was dating men in addiction. Mm-hmm. And it took me a really long time to sort that out. I was like, what is this thing? And I would go to CODA, I would go to AA meetings, like do the steps, have friends that I still talk about the steps with. Like it's still in my vocabulary because I noticed that compulsion. It's still this place inside me that's like, if I can change or rewrite the story for someone else, then I can maybe do it for myself. If I can help someone else that much, then I could probably maybe help myself. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting piece to notice, that really strong desire. And it was so genuine to help these men that I dated in their addiction. But really it was like learning to offer that to myself first. And I had gone through eating disorder treatment, and I was in a relationship with someone who struggles with addiction or struggled. And the relationship ended in turbulence, as it usually does when you're dating someone who's, you know, was more than likely relapsing in their addiction, you know, in the okay. moment I loved them. And so I wasn't calling them out on it. But now I look back and I was like, Ailey, they were using, like, you know, it fell yeah. apart, not nicely. And I remember sitting there and just being like, I just want to love this person. I just want to help them heal. Like, da, 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 da. Had all of these stories of what I wanted to do. And then there was just like this moment where I was just like, but why don't I offer any of that to myself? Mm-hmm. Why am I like sitting here, like thinking like, oh, therapy could benefit them, or like yoga could benefit them, like meditation, like, you know, all these things. I'm like, why don't I go do those things? So right. Genuinely went online and I looked, and I was like, treatment for like childhood trauma, like what I would have picked for them, and signed myself up.
Oh, wow. Wise.
There was something else coming on there that was like, if I'm with someone who's struggling with their mental health in this way, I'm probably also struggling with my mental health in a similar or somewhat similar way.
Oh my God. Stop calling me out. No, but yeah, that's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the best decisions I ever made for my life, I met a therapist there who, white male, very good looking, affluent, you know, white male therapist, never thought I would ever work with someone like that. And the best trauma therapist that I have worked with. And also, he had a rule in therapy that was really wonderful for me. He was like, in our relationship and in our dynamic, he's like, you can't speak about the eating disorder. Mm. And he set this rule, and he was like, we have another therapist for you to do that with, but with me, we're going to talk about your relationship and your trauma. Can we have that deal? And it allowed me to really fuse out this pattern of eating disorder symptoms and relationships with men. Hmm. And really get some clarity about that, because he kind of set this boundary with me.
Right.
That I couldn't do that with him.
Like project those things onto your eating disorder or vice versa, and then get it all messy and convoluted. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Different approach.
Yeah. And,
now that he's a colleague, I have talked to him about it, and he's like, oh, I don't even really remember doing that. He's like, but I just remember wanting it to be really clear.
Yeah.
Really clear about our intention. And our intention was trauma and men. And I was like, wow, that was pretty bold of you. Like,
yeah. You really got to have some like gusto as a therapist to be like, no, laying on the line. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And I think that's so fascinating too, because even for people listening who maybe don't date addicts, right? Mm-hmm. Dating someone who has never been to therapy and needs to go to therapy, or dating someone who runs away from their problems, or dating someone who X, Y, and Z that you are trying to fix and you're so busy fixing instead of focusing on yourself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that is such, like, if in your relationship you're more focused on fixing or fixing the other person, fixing the relationship.
Explaining, understanding.
Oh my God. Having compassion for, holding space for, witnessing. Like, if your main priority is them in the relationship, not yourself, in kind of an equal balance, or not just yourself, depending on where you are in that spectrum of codependency, then there's probably some problems in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that trap. It's such a trap that especially, like, really empathetic people get into. This trap of, like, I just want to understand them. I just want to explain them. I just want to get it, you know, all this stuff. And then once I became aware of my own pattern in that regard, I'd catch my friends do it. And I'd be like, okay, wait, why are we still talking about him?
Yeah.
Like, can we change the subject? Like, it doesn't matter why he did that. He did it.
He's his own person with his own stuff. And until he's willing to show up and do his own work and grow, like, we can't really do anything about it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's the other piece. I just feel like women are socialized from a very young age to make generous assumptions of kindness when it comes to male behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we don't do that for other women. We don't generously assume other women are kind and wonderful and sincere, but we do that for men. And I'm like, why? Like, just, you could make some assumptions, but they don't have to be generously large, like, proportional. Like,
yeah. And I think, you know, there's something to be said about this desire that we, like, want to know that we picked someone who does have good intention, that we wouldn't pick someone who is, like, out to hurt us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole other conversation that we should probably save for a different podcast episode. But I think, you know, when you boil it down, it's not a reflection of you or what you're picking of person, like, whatever. Like, it's not something to blame yourself for.
Yeah.
It just is.
With that, in my most previous ending relationship, engagement, whatever the terms are on that, when I got out of it, I had so much. I was like, oh my God, I have all these clinical skills, I've had lots of healthy relationships for years. Like, what happened in that? Like, how did I pick this person? And then I had to really go back and look at it. And I was like, what part of me, like, what part of Ailey, who's been through all these experiences, when acknowledging that when we go through trauma, we fragment and different parts of our personality develop and leave. Like, what part of me, was it adult Ailey that picked this person? Was it wise Ailey? Or was it wounded Ailey? Did wounded Ailey say, hey, this person, I think maybe they were what I was always looking for.
Mm-hmm.
They're what I know, actually. And when I could get to that place of, like, oh, it was like wounded 4-year-old Ailey, and she wanted some time to in adult life, and this is what she knows. When I could get to that place and honor her choice, then it was just like compassion and love for myself and forgiveness, because that blame was no longer there. And also that ownership of, like, there was a part of me that was attracted to that.
Mm.
What is that part? And how can she get her needs met in a different way today?
Right. And I think the wording there is really important, because when I say it's not a reflection of you, what I really mean to say is it's not something to blame yourself for. But it is a part. There's someone, some version of you, some inner child who is looking for whatever, fill in the blank.
Yeah. And that's not a justification for abuse in any such way. And there's also, and I'm constantly kind of working this out and in my advocacy of, like, how do we also own these parts of ourselves that are unhealed, that are going out into the world and making decisions and choices in a world that isn't always safe, that has other unhealed people that are doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the agency, in that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is good. This is really good. Before we wrap up, what is like one thing you would say to someone who's like deep in it and listening to this out of some pure cosmic attraction?
I actually know. It was staring at me. My own book was staring at me in a cosmic attraction kind of thing. So it's right at the end of my book, and I say this to clients sometimes. The words I want your heart to hear, that whatever happens in life, that it belongs to you and you alone. So make it yours, take it, feed it to yourself, even if it suffocates you as you swallow it whole. It will nurture you, it will become you. It will be the new marrow of your bones. It will be the essence and strength of your being. There is beauty in your brokenness.
Hmm.
Yeah, there is in the messiest, darkest times. That is when that inner healer, that beauty, that eternal essence, whatever you want to call it, is most present. Things have to fall apart sometimes to be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
That's a part of it. And the other piece of advice that I give often comes from my own therapist. And she always says, slow down, you'll get there faster.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
If I could give younger Ailey 2 pieces of advice, it would be that. Like, the beauty of your brokenness, slow down, you'll get there faster.
Yeah. Yeah. My version of that actually, which is so, again, cosmic, divine intervention, whatever, is when you feel the urge to go fast, slow down. Has been so important for me recently, because I regularly feel the urge to go fast. And I'm like, oh, that's that thing that's trying to keep me safe by winning immediately and doing all these things. You know what I mean? Like, sure. Trying to go, go, go. And like, yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yes. Thank you so much for sharing. Do you have anything going on that you would like to promote or talk about?
Not specifically. I always am doing clinical counseling. I see clients online. Mm-hmm. At the end of the year, I will be doing a retreat in Bali that blends yoga. It's mostly focused around like embodiment work, embodied meditations, holding space for some deeper psychotherapy work with another yoga teacher who has recovered from disordered eating as well. So yeah, the dates for that will be coming up soon.
Ooh, please let me know. I will at the very least pass that along, and at the most potentially just come join. So I'm always, yeah, that's amazing. I'm like kind of obsessed with you right now. I feel like this is going to be start to a friendship. So I'm excited.
It was so lovely to chat with you.
It was great chatting with you.
If you are loving the Trust Your Body Project podcast and are ready to dive headfirst into your healing transformation, head on over to WhitneyCatalano.com/food-freedom to learn more about working with me. WhitneyCatalano.com/food-freedom.